It is 24 minutes to 10. You're listening to RN, and it's time for our Sunday roundtable. So it's a complaint that's being repeated all over the country. Household bills are going up, but there isn't a wage increase in sight. Despite an upturn in the economy and a downturn in unemployment, our wages have remained low for the better part of a decade. Even the decision to raise the minimum wage by 3.3% hasn't done much to improve the overall wage situation. And if you listen to the governor of the Reserve Bank, Philip Lowe, all it takes apparently to improve the situation is for us to walk into the boss's office and ask for a wage rise. So is that really what it takes? And if so, why aren't more of us doing it? Let's get to our panel to answer those questions. And you may have a question of your own to put to them as well. So do text RN on 0418-226-576. Let's meet our panelists this morning. Chris Richardson, a partner from Deloitte Access Economics. Joanne Masters is a senior economist from ANZ. And Greg Jericho is an economics and political reporter, writer with Guardian Australia. Welcome to you all.
Morning.
Great, thanks.
Chris, if I could start with you, it does have to be pointed out that it isn't just Australia that's seeing this dismal state of wages. Now, the IMF says that most advanced economies are in the same position with wage increases markedly lower than before the 2008 global financial crisis. So explain to us, how is Australia faring when it comes to the wage growth situation? Are we one of the worst or one of the better ones on the international stage?
Look, it is a mix, and it has to be said that Australia has been moving down the rankings in the sense of relatively getting worse, though that probably says a little about our economy versus some other economies around the world. But yes, this is not just an Australian story, and there are some elements that are evident all around the world and here at home behind this. You know, the global financial crisis was a big thing, with a lingering impact. In Australia, it was a smaller thing, but we then had a slowdown in China to deal with. And that impact on unemployment and underemployment around the world has had something of a lingering impact. Also, by the way, not just on wages, but on its close cousin of prices. Mm. So the wage growth is bad, but in some ways it's not quite as bad as people might think at first blush, because inflation itself has also been weak.
Right, right. Now, Joanne, would you agree that the ghost of the GFC has frightened businesses into being conservative? But really, it happened almost a decade ago.
Look, absolutely. I think the shadow from the GFC has been quite long, and I think it's impacted both corporates and also employees. We know that post-GFC job insecurity has remained quite elevated. So workers are more fearful for the security of their job, which makes it harder to ask for wage increases. And we know that corporates are facing increasing focus around costs, and that started with the GFC and has certainly continued. And one of the easiest costs to control, of course, is your labour costs. So I think that's absolutely right.
And Greg, companies do have more bargaining power now over their workers because of the GFC?
Well, not so much just because of the GFC. There's other factors in place that have been long-term trends. The big one is the decline in the union membership. I mean, even back at the turn of the century, you could say a quarter of workers were in a trade union. Now it's down to around 15%. In the private sector, it's barely above 10%. And that certainly does reduce their bargaining power. And it's something that really wasn't so much due to the GFC, but there are factors within that. In after the GST, there was the employment growth for a number of years was more pronounced on part-time work, which is less likely to involve people in trade unions, and also people who are perhaps feeling less confident about the security of their position and are more concerned about increasing hours rather than increasing the wage rate. Mm.
A listener just texted in to say, "Hi, Fauzia, I haven't had a pay rise in nearly 8 years. Is this normal?" Now, Greg, a report by the OECD shows that the Australian economy is continuing to grow at a robust pace and that the jobs market is strengthening further. In the past, though, such elements would lead to wage growth. So why isn't that happening now?
Well, in the past, we always, economists used to like using a thing called the Phillips curve, where we looked at basically wage growth and the unemployment rate, and the sense was if unemployment goes down, then wages will go up. But what's happened since about the end of 2014, that relationship has kind of broken down. The unemployment rate's gone down, but so has the wages growth. But what has stayed in sync is the link between underemployment and wages growth. And so underemployment at the moment is pretty much at a record high, and our wages growth is pretty much at a record low. So it might be the case that what's more important now is the relationship with underemployment rather than unemployment.
Okay, so before we go any further, Chris, if I could tap on you here, just explain to us who may not know what underemployment means. What does that term actually cover, and is it actually contributing to this slow wage growth?
Look, Greg is absolutely right on that front. Underemployment is a big part of the story here, and it is full-time workers who would have been working more hours if they could, if their employers were letting them. It's part-time workers who'd like to work full-time and the like. And those used to move very much together. In the last handful of years, that combination between the two is a little less obvious. And that's a problem. Basically, the trade-off, if you like, the strength in the economy is showing up not just in Australia, but in a number of economies around the world, more in jobs than it is in wages. And the net trade-off is not one that, you know, on the raw numbers is loved, but it has an additional layer. Even if you get a bunch of people getting jobs, and that's true in Australia in recent times, that tends to be good news for those people and relative to the total mass of people, that's not heaps. Whereas wage growth is a smaller amount of good news for more people. And so if you like, one of the side effects of this change trade-off that we're getting is that it's a smaller number of people getting the good news.
Joanne, are we seeing more part-time employment? Is that on the rise rather than full-time employment?
Look, absolutely. That's a structural trend where we're seeing increased part-time workers. Now, a lot of that is related to increased female participation in the workforce. So many women with their caring responsibilities like to work part-time. We've also got older Australians staying in the workforce for longer, and some of those also like to work part-time. And actually, some of the younger generation also making different work-life choices or working more than one job, so working part-time in those jobs. So we're absolutely seeing that. And that is also, you know, that's certainly part of the changing dynamic that we've seen. Mm-hmm. In the last 12 months, though, the bulk of jobs created have been full-time. So 300,000 out of the 350,000 jobs that we've created in the last year have been full-time jobs. But I do think the increase in part-time workers is part of the reason why we're seeing this increase in the underemployment rate. I think it's easier for part-time workers to want to work more hours. So we have a lot of people that have a three-day job but would like to work 4 days or the like. I also think the increase in part-time employment has also been something that corporates and companies and firms and small businesses in particular have welcomed, because it does give them a little bit of flexibility around shifting sort of demand and activity in their business.
So is it a case then, Joanne, of, as Philip Lowe says, of simply walking up to the boss and demanding a pay rise? Isn't there a fear that you could easily be replaced if you rock the boat?
Look, absolutely. I don't think it's that simple. I think that from a worker's point of view, an employee's point of view, as I said, we know that job insecurity is elevated post-GFC. We also know that people are reading all the time about artificial intelligence, about technology, about a more globalized workforce, and all of those things are threatening your job insecurity. And of course, we know that households are holding records amount of debt. And so I think that also plays into this need to keep your job, this fear of what will happen if you don't keep your job. So I think it's actually quite hard for workers to go and demand pay rises. And on the flip side of that, I think in an increasingly globalized, competitive marketplace, corporates, as I said, are very focused on costs and probably relatively reluctant to increase their wage bill significantly unless they've got offsetting productivity gains.
Okay, Chris. So if businesses want to reduce costs, the question, though, is are shareholders actually benefiting at the expense of the workers?
Ultimately, shareholders are going to do best if the business makes the right decisions. And
if the right decision means cutting down on costs as well as wages, is that the right decision?
And that's the thing. You know, if all businesses are only focused on costs, then ultimately you don't have a growing economy and it does not work as a strategy. There will be times in individual industries, individual businesses, where it makes enormous sense. But that basic point that Joe was mentioning a moment ago, that businesses are more conservative and indeed the workers are more conservative. We are scaredy cats, not just because we know that economies can do bad things. We're a bit worried by the political uncertainty, and perhaps most of all, it's the rise of the robots that has a bunch of people spooked. Workers and, again, businesses and people think, oh, you know, and so those decisions are being a little too conservative.
Mm. Greg, what would it take then for this conservatism, I suppose, to be turned around? What would it take for an employee to feel secure enough to walk into a boss's office and say, I know you can afford it, we need a wage rise?
Well, I think probably the best way would to have her union representatives do it rather than him or herself. I've certainly, it's never easy for you to do it, but if it's part of an enterprise bargaining agreement, that's where there is a bit more power. Mm. And one of the problems with, and this is something internationally as well, is with the increased globalization, essentially, we're at the, I guess, almost the tail end of 30, nearly 40 years of industrial relations policy that has kind of led us to this point where we've swallowed almost the belief we need more flexibility, the ability to hire and fire at will or change pay rates and so forth, which inevitably leads us to this situation where you have lower wage growth because people are worried about international competitive and so forth. And, mm-hmm. and I'm not really quite sure how we get out of this. The sense that, if the economy picks up, that everything will right itself, I'm not quite sure that will happen either, because even when the OECD is talking about, we're going to have solid or robust growth, they're talking about growth which 10 years ago would have been considered a bit subpar. So what we're even considering as being sort of average growth has lowered across the board. And so I can't see us getting back to those 3%, 3.5% average wage growth periods for a very long time. I think there is almost a bit of a shift and I'm not really quite sure how you sort of shock the system out of it.
Shock the system, I like that. Maybe that's what we all need, actually, to shock the system. Now, Chris, is this, though, the new norm? Does that mean that we do have to get used to low wage growth, that, you know, the big rises of the 90s or the 80s pre-GFC are no longer? This is the new norm.
I think today's rates of wage growth of under 2% is not the new norm. It will take time to shake it. As Greg said, it won't happen fast. On our forecast, you're basically, at the year 2020 before wage growth in Australia is back at 3%. But you are starting to see some good things. There are basically two things that you need. And we would say that those two are already in place. You need businesses making more money, and that's been true for the last 18 months or so. And you need job growth good enough to be moving underemployment, which we've correctly been focusing on, move that down, and that peaked about 9 months ago. It's only just edged down. But that combination should be enough for something of a return. Slow return. It's going to be a game of inches.
Yeah, when you say return, slow, how slow are we talking about? How many years? are we talking about?
Sure. So it's 2020 before our forecasts have wage growth in Australia at 3%. Mm. They average across the longer term thereafter about 3.3%. You can compare that to the budget forecasts, which have a faster bounce and a return to a higher level. And why that's important is when you're talking about wages, you're talking about one of the great, you know, it's an enormous part of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories extend well beyond, you know, families quite rightly are worried about wages, but treasurers worry about wages because they get more tax out of wage growth than they get out of job growth. Everybody from, you know, insurance companies to aged care homes have to worry about wage growth because wage growth ultimately drives price growth and inflation drives a range of business models across the economy.
Now, we had been talking about inflation and you know, it does seem that Australia's inflation is not really that high. However, Joanne, we're still seeing the rising price of electricity, of gas and housing prices as well. So we're all feeling the pinch. Is it a case of perhaps re-looking at the way we look at the basket of goods that we measure our wages against?
Look, I don't think so. I think the CPI or the Consumer Price Index is still the best reading of what households are actually facing in terms of inflation. And in fact, in the next data point that we get for that, we will have some updated weights about expenditure patterns from households. So that's a very encouraging step forward. I think what we've got on inflation at the moment is we do have historically very low inflation. That's not unique to Australia. But what we are seeing is relatively high inflation for non-discretionary items. So the things that we have to buy that we can't really control how much we buy. So things like electricity, childcare, health insurance. So those prices are actually rising quite quickly. On the flip side, we've actually got prices falling in some items, particularly in the retail space, so clothing, footwear, sports and camping equipment and the like. So we've got this real dichotomy at the moment. And I think for households, one of the problems is that you can reduce how much you consume in that retail space, but where you can't reduce your consumption, so your electricity and education fees and the like, you know, those prices are rising quite highly. So in the mind of the consumer, it feels like your cost of living is actually rising much faster than actually the overall average is. So I do think low inflation is here to stay. I mean, we have a similar profile for wages as Chris has got, a very, very gradual lift in wage growth. And we've also got a very, very gradual lift in inflation.
All right. So in the meantime, we've all got to tighten our belts. However, is it a case, Greg, of perhaps reducing the personal income tax so that Australians are able to deal with the rising prices, it seems?
Well, I wouldn't be recommending that. I don't think that certainly is not a policy that I'd recommend to deal with sort of low wages growth and cost of living. There are issues with bracket creep, but one of the issues with bracket creep is it's actually less of an issue when you do have low wages growth. I think there is perhaps a reason to look at it, but I always, one of the things is tax cuts don't actually pay for themselves, and if you're going to bring in a tax cut, you've got to worry about how you're going to pay for that, and that will generally mean cuts in government services. And so while a tax cut might seem like a nice sort of way to give people a bit more money in their pocket, I always like to know what are we giving up for it.
That's a really good point. I want to go back to the labour force and perhaps what the labour force is actually or how it's contributing to this low wage growth. Chris, we're seeing many young graduates join the labour force. They're willing to take on a low paid job just to get their foot in the door. Is that in some way contributing to the stagnant wage growth?
Look, there's a little bit of that story, I'd sit that in a wider context. It isn't that the old relationships around wage growth are dead. They're just less strong than they used to be. And so other things equal, you know, when you've got too many workers chasing something, you know, true in mining at the moment, true in Western Australia, and by the by, you know, mining at the industry level, Western Australia at the state level are the two places where wage growth is worst. Equally, some of the areas where wage growth is strongest is where job growth is greatest. So when you've got a bunch of graduates and some of them in the wrong areas at the wrong time, that is holding down wages in those industries. So there's a big question around what's the education doing and are we studying the right things? But I wouldn't say it's make or break for the wider picture. But it is part of a story that don't forget, you are still getting wages reacting to what's going on in conditions. You know, you can see it in industries, you can see it in with graduates, you can see it by states. It's just not as strong as it used to be.
Joanne, you've spoken about the globalization of the workforce and the impact of automation on jobs. We are seeing more industries become automated. Talk to us about what that actually means for wage growth in the future.
Well, look, we are starting to see it, and we're probably, only at the very start of that process. We're seeing a lot of technological change, increasing automation, and the things that we can do for it. And it's starting to impact areas that I guess we didn't think it would do 10 years ago or so. So for example, in the legal profession, in the medical profession, where we are seeing some of that AI and that technological change. I think about it is that whilst there are some jobs that exist today that won't exist in the future, we are actually also creating new jobs. So people, I think, often, you know, they open the newspaper and they can read that my job may not exist in 5 years' time or so, but actually we'll be needing other skills and new jobs. So I think it's really important to think about what the future looks like and to try to start to train for that and obviously particularly important for younger workers.
But where does that then leave older workers and the more experienced workers, those who may not be used to the automation of their jobs? I mean, then younger workers are coming in and undercutting them.
Well, look, I think so. I mean, I think for, I guess this change is going to be reasonably gradual. It's not in the next sort of 12 months or so. So, look, I do think that there's a challenge for older Australians. I don't think all jobs are going to be disrupted, but a lot of those sort of manual jobs will be disrupted. Mm-hmm. So I think, look, I absolutely think it's a challenge. And you're quite right. Often you find young workers perhaps are either better trained or a bit more agile and a bit more able to be flexible around what they can do. But look, it's coming. It's a challenge, and it's one that we need to try to manage as an economy. And I think right across the board, no matter what industry you look at, the potential for disruption, whether that's technology or digital disruption, is absolutely there. Right. Is that playing into weak wage growth now? Well, probably, because I think it's playing into job insecurity.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me on the Sunday Roundtable. That's Chris Richardson from Deloitte Access Economics, Joanne Masters with ANZ, and Greg Jericho of The Guardian Australia.